Hello and welcome to Brainstorm, a show exploring new ideas and insights about Ireland and the world. I'm Ronan Kelly. About a third of us live in towns, but how much do we actually know about these towns? How are they doing and what does the future look like for them? For example, what challenges do they face? From vacant properties to commuter towns to climate change threats. We have two people with us who are specialists in research into Irish towns. Dr. Philip Crowe, who's a lecturer and assistant professor from the School of Architecture, Planning and Environmental Policy at UCD. And Dr. Susan Hegarty from the School of History and Geography in DCU, where she is the institutional lead for DCU Futures and a professor in physical and environmental geography. Philip, as part of your research, you helped set up the Centre for Irish Towns in UCD.
Yep.
Tell us about that. What's that all about?
Well, the Centre for Irish Towns is really an attempt to bring together different stakeholders and different academics who are looking at towns and researching towns so that we collate all the information together and we try and make a difference on the ground in towns in Ireland.
And why focus on towns? Why that interest?
Well, I think why not? I mean, it's, as you have said, a third of us live in towns. There's another third live rurally. And if you live in a rural environment, you tend to be reliant on a town or connected in some way to a town. They're key to service provision. They're key to life. Life converges in our Irish towns and they're endlessly interesting. So,
and have you come across anything in your research lately that you thought, well, I wasn't aware of that, or the fact that I'm collaborating with other people has really brought something to light that I wasn't aware of?
Oh, I think constantly every town is different. It's a cliche, but it's true. Every town has its own problems, but it also has its own qualities, its own very special sense of place. Critically, it always has amazing people in every town who are doing extraordinary things.
Give me an example. What's one you've come across that you...
Oh, well, I could start with Castle Blaney in County Monaghan. I've done some work there and very small place, 3,600, I think, people. And it's extraordinary the number of people who are actively involved in their community. But there's a particular group, the town team. There was also a sustainable energy team in the town, and there was some crossover between those groups. But people that are absolutely committed to the future of their town and really believe in the place. And they do make things happen.
That's interesting. Is that luck or is it just people happen to be together at the same time and somebody is driving it?
Is it luck that they got together?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think these places are very small.
Traditionally, that might have been the parish priest or somebody with a bit of drive who might have...
Yes, and obviously that has all changed. The times have evolved. I think people have got together in somewhere like Castle Blaney who have a shared interest. They meet socially, I suspect, and it's a very small place. What's wonderful about a lot of our towns is that they are very strong on social cohesion, on people interacting with one another. And it doesn't need to be in the pub or in the church. It could be just on the street, which is the perfect public place to meet people. And they get together and they think, well, we could make a difference if we put our heads together. And the town team that I'm talking about in Castle Blaney, that model has been rolled out now. The Town Centre First policy, which is relatively new, I think 2022, is encouraging or setting up town teams in a lot of towns across the country. And there are many other examples of town teams.
I'll ask you about that. Susan, you're going to be known to people from being on TV with the documentaries about Building Ireland. You also wrote a piece for Brainstorm about the design of Shannon Newtown. What's your interest in towns?
Again, like Philip, I just find towns fascinating.
Do you?
And mainly because each one is so different. Each one has been developed in a different way. So from, those towns which are Viking origin to the market towns, we are really lucky in Ireland because we have so many little towns. And most of these towns have come about because we are heavily agricultural in our history. And we needed places for this agriculture to be brought to market and to be sold. And traditionally, you could only bring things a certain distance because milk, for example, would go off if it was brought any distance at all. So you develop...
Can you actually map that?
Can
you say, this is why this town has grown up here, because Kilmallock is here because it's X miles away from...
So if you actually look at a map of towns of Ireland, you can see that they're spatially... you can see the spatial cohesion of them and the spatial distribution because of this, them being close to marketplace or close to the hinterland of the agricultural area, which is fascinating in itself. Each one of those then gets a different gets a different, I suppose, flavour because of what's being sold on them or because of how they've developed.
Give me an example of that.
So recently I was in, I was up in North County Cork, in some of the towns around that area, which are in the Golden Vale.
Mm.
And all of those
wealthy towns.
Wealthy towns, exactly. Yeah. And all of those have developed because of the dairy industry. So you've got these creameries and the which then get amalgamated into larger creameries. And so you've got places like Charleville, Mitchelstown, all these towns which have developed because of, particularly Charleville, which has developed because of the dairy industry in the area and the farmers coming together to sell their produce.
The town gets its name from the Irish word for hollow, and in recent years it lived up or down to its name, falling into a deep valley period in its fortunes. Hit badly by cross-border trading and resultant unemployment, Cavan became a grand town to come from. Now all has changed. The huge input of public sector investment has stirred everyone to renewed faith, a confidence that is tangible. The old market square, once a run-down and shabby patch, has been given a sculpture and fountain, an oasis and focal point for locals and visitors alike.
So if you were landed into one of those towns, without having seen the road sign, would you be able to tell what kind of town you're in and why it developed in a certain way?
In some senses, yes. In other senses, like Ireland is so, the Irish towns are just so interesting because each one, as you say, has an individual flavour. So you've got things like these market towns, and then you've got these other planted towns like Westport, where you've got a landlord who's come in who's decided he wants a town and has designed the town.
Mm.
So you know, you've got Westport, you've got even again going back to Mitchelstown in Cork, these other towns which are designed.
Tell me about some of the design. How would you know from the buildings or the streets?
You've got these perfectly straight lines, and traditional in older Irish towns the streets aren't straight, but in these planted towns you've got beautifully straight lines,
okay,
which are all leading towards a market square, which are leading towards the big house the other end. So you've got perfectly beautiful avenues, and everything looks proper, right and proper.
Okay.
Whereas in an older Irish town, maybe something that's like from the Viking or even one of the older settlements, you've got a bit of higgledy-piggledy. It's all, you know, you're not quite sure of where things are going, because it's all developed organically. Perhaps around a church, perhaps around another settlement, or just around a river itself.
I was looking at your research, Philip, and you had studied in Scotland and you studied this guy named Geddes.
Yes.
Who dealt with breaking up grids and was interested in what he called folk planning rather than town planning. And it seemed to be he had that attitude towards towns, making them a little bit more reflective of the people in them.
No, I think what he was interested in was the layers of interest in a town. So he was very interested in the social, the cultural, the environmental, the topographical aspects of towns. And what he saw when he looked at towns was potential. Quite often it was, he would describe it as quite messy. So if you take the old town of Edinburgh at his time, I should give his dates, 1854 to 1932. I should know because I did my PhD on the Perman. But everybody had moved to the new town of Edinburgh, which is this rational plan, and had left the old town, which is the medieval city, which goes from the castle to the palace. And it was a mess. It was, you know, it had no sanitation. It was very poor. Buildings were in disrepair. And I think he had an instinct to tidy everything up. But that doesn't make an awful lot of sense whenever the urban fabric itself is a little bit higgledy-piggledy. So his idea was to survey, understand the place, understand the adaptive capacity of that place. And he did this for Dublin as well,
did he?
For example. And figure out, well, what do I remove here? What can we remove? What can we reuse? And what can we add? And that was a mechanism that he developed, an approach that he developed called conservative surgery. So he loved medical analogies, but it was basically surgery for the time. And it's a really interesting approach that you can still see today in our times, in new proposals for our times, which have been made.
And does that involve throwing people out of their houses if they're broken down houses and they don't fit in with his plan?
No, what he would be looking at is, you know, quite often a building will be so derelict that you can't save it. And
okay.
So he would, well, we could remove that building, and that would be quite interesting because it would connect through to that space, or you could create a small park there, etc. And it would be an exercise in editing, an exercise in reusing, and an exercise in adding things into the town to make the town work better socially and economically and environmentally.
Okay. And we did mention that, Susan, that you looked at a greenfield site, which was Shannon Newtown, and they had the options to do whatever they wanted. And they did seem to have some interesting things in terms of cars and people, even though they were built at the peak of car usage in the 60s and 70s here.
Absolutely.
What did you find out about that?
The example of Shannon is really interesting because it was built in the 1960s, as you say, a peak of car usage, and was built around two things. It was built around cars and people. And so it was built, all of the houses within Shannon, you could get to any house walking through a back road, and the front of the houses were all to do with the car movement throughout. But interestingly, for a town that is named for a river, it turned its back on the river.
Oh.
So it was using some of the topography of the area. So you do have, you know, Philip just mentioned around using topography and using the landscape. What they ended up doing in Shannon was using one of the hills as one of the main areas, but then not integrating the actual river itself into the townscape, which makes it a town which looks like an inland town, but actually it's a town with a beautiful estuary just beside it. But what's interesting about Shannon itself is that concept of having a town where people could be within a local community. They had, each particular community had a church within it, had a shop within it, all of which were walkable. And then the cars were on the outside to bring people out to other areas. But all of these areas then were interlinked. So you had a community building up in this greenfield site in a very modern way at the time.
And yet they tried that in Darndale in Dublin, and they had people's houses looked out onto walking areas, but the backs of the houses was a road, and that then became used by joyriders.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't work so well there.
It didn't work so well. But I don't know how much you guys are involved in policy and how much you're confining yourselves to research. Like, the research seems fascinating. Are you then trying to develop policy out of it, or are you mainly looking at...
Philip, I think, might be more policy driven.
Yeah, well, I don't know, but certainly a lot of the work we do, we try to make it very much applied research, and we like to see, you know, how does the research impact on the existing policy environment, and what could we suggest that might work well. So an example would be myself and Orla Murphy, who Susan knows well, and Madeline Lies, two colleagues. We wrote a report for the Department of Rural and Community Development on what was called the Town Centre Living Initiative, which was basically giving six towns across the country that I'm going to try and remember now, Ballinrobe, Banagher, Boyle, and Castleblayney, Callan and Cappoquin. Very easy to remember because of BBBCCC.
Good man.
I think that was possibly why they were chosen. I'm not sure. And we were just given the six towns to write a report about. But each town had to look at vacancy and town centre living. And we did a synthesis report where we came out with about 15 different suggested actions as to how towns might be revived, or just different ideas about how you might govern the town, or how you might demonstrate to people that their town had huge potential and that there were alternative modes of housing, etc. And those 15 suggested actions, I am reliably informed, very much influenced really the only policy we have in the country on towns, which is called the Town Centre First Policy Approach.
Tell me what that is.
basically looks at how do we revive our towns in Ireland.
Okay. And what kind of examples did people come up with? What kind of initiatives did people
come up with? Well, I suppose some of the flagship aspects of that were putting a town regeneration officer in every local authority. Now, that's a pretty ambitious thing for one person to be able to manage all the towns. So if you take a county like Cork, I don't know how many towns Cork has, but it's a lot. Take a county like Waterford, actually has less towns in it. So it's this county divide, is interesting. But they have employed town regeneration officers who are basically coordinating and directing the direction of travel for towns so that there's somebody coordinating things. Whereas before, and particularly since the abolition of in 2014 of the town councils, towns were being managed by the local authority, and perhaps that wasn't in such a coordinated manner. What else came out of the town centre first? So far they've developed vision plans, essentially, or master plans for about 26 towns in the first phase, and I think there's another 26 that are maybe being completed at the moment. So they provided funding for that, and a lot of towns have gone through that process.
But you do need central government to get behind a lot of these ideas, or can they be driven by the local authorities?
Well, funding tends to come from central government.
Right.
The local authorities are, as we know, we live in a very centralised country, and that is really evident in how this has been set up.
Yeah.
But the Town Centre First office has been set up in the Local Government Management Association, the LGMA.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I've got that acronym right. And that was on foot of a recommendation that we had made in that report, which was to have what we called an Ireland's Towns Partnership, which was to be modelled on something that exists in Scotland. The Scots are really, really ahead of the game when it comes to revitalising towns and looking after their towns.
Are they? Because you would go through some Scottish towns and see a lot of boarded up places and betting shops and charity shops.
I think that's exactly why they're putting a huge effort into dealing with them.
All right.
But they have this little agile office that is actually a social enterprise funded by the government largely, called Scotland's Towns Partnership. And it's four or five people as far as I can make out. I asked the question to the chief executive, who happens to be from Armagh, although I think he's moved on now. It sounds like an enormous organisation, but it was literally four or five people. And because they're not attached to the local authority or any particular department, they're able to move about. They're agile and they're dynamic, and they answered to a minister directly. And as far as we can make out, it's been a very effective organisation.
That's interesting, because we would in the past have had a notion that when the businesses go out of the town, the big businesses that make the town work, they're then relying on government to send jobs their way or to help revitalise the towns. I remember in the early 2000s, you remember, sure, the effort to decentralise government departments out of Dublin was the initiative of Tom Parlin. And just have a quick listen to a clip of Jim Fahey talking to Taoiseach Bertie Ahern in 2004 about it.
The Taoiseach came to Ballybrit this evening to go racing and to gamble again on being able to pick a winner. His bet was a modest €50 on the first race favourite, Posh Paddy. And he quickly brushed aside suggestions that the decentralisation programme would stumble at the first hurdle and not hit its 3-year target.
We mightn't, we were a bit behind on Lewis and the decent, but three years will come, 4 years will come, 5 years will come, I never get too excited about things. A bit like Christmas, it always comes.
Did it happen? Did the decentralisation happen much?
Well, I think there are several departments. I know
Dead.
In Tipperary Town and in Trim, there are government departments that were decentralised. As to how successful they've been, I think I'm not the man to ask.
People sneered at it, but it seemed like it could have been a good idea.
Could have been a good idea. And as Philip says, elements were decentralised. So the Department of Education is in Athlone, and other elements or other departments are scattered. But I think that Dublin has always had a pull for people. So it wasn't as successful as perhaps it might have been. It seemed like a good idea on paper, but actually, to ask people to move, which is effectively what what was happening at the time was, you know, people were saying, oh, we're going to relocate this element to this place.
Quickly. Yeah.
And, you know, asking people to move their families was, I think, a little bit a bridge too far for some people.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't as successful as perhaps it might have been. And that owes a lot to the draw of Dublin. Philip mentioned the fact that we are a centralised country in terms of government. We're also very centralised in terms of geography. We've got most of the population living within the Greater Dublin area. And that acts as a draw.
So, other than tilting the country, how do you get people to move out of Dublin? How do you get people to?
I think that one of the things that's been really interesting over the past number of years, and particularly since COVID, is that rural Ireland has acted as a draw again to people, because we realise that we can live in other places, because, you know, we don't have to necessarily travel we don't necessarily have to commute. We can work from home, and in fact, rural Ireland, in most areas, not everywhere, but it is, the population of these towns is actually increasing.
Right.
As I say, it's not everywhere, so there are towns.
But it needs broadband.
But it needs broadband.
Public
needs
transport or motorways.
Absolutely. Yeah. It needs the resources being put in.
We're going through a nationwide housing crisis now. But if you go back to 1990, the Rural Resettlement Initiative sought to bring families from Dublin to counties such as Clare, where small towns and villages had dwindling populations. Drive Time's John Cook spoke to Susan Morgan from West Dublin, who made the switch.
What's the biggest difference between Blanchardstown and Labouchedda?
The lack of services, like no taxis handy, you're not half an hour away from the shops, and public transport is a zero. But I love it here. The pros definitely outweigh the cons. We're definitely a lot happier.
Susan Morgan and her four children swapped life in West Dublin for West Clare in August of 2014.
We were living in Blanchardstown. It was just getting crazy. Now, to each their own, everybody loves it, other people don't. I was one of the people that didn't love it. So I moved away out of there because it was too expensive to live in Dublin. So my son had to walk to Coolmine School, which is a good 45 minutes from our house. And I'd be terrified him going on his own, you know, so.
So you decided, I'm moving down the country?
Moving down the country. Up sticks and left.
The interesting thing is we've been talking about the influences on town. So you're talking about Castleblayney and the local pride and the local people getting involved. And you're talking about locally supported initiatives by local authorities. But your research shows that the big impacts on towns are probably one of the reasons where most of them are located was water. Mm-hmm. But the big impact now is going to be water.
Mm-hmm.
What's that about? What's that?
So one of the impacts of climate and I suppose not only climate change, but even just environmental degradation is the impact that it's having on water. And of late, I've been doing quite a lot of work with community groups in both rural and urban areas, trying to encourage people to look after the water and to be stewards of the local water. Because
that's kind of hard if you're living on a river and the river's going to flood and you can't tell.
Absolutely. But one of the things that's important is going back to that sense of local pride and local knowledge of what's happening in that local area. So a lot of the, as you mentioned, a lot of the towns and villages and even cities in Ireland are built up around rivers.
Mm.
And so we've lived with the river for millennia in some cases.
But it was a predictable river.
But it was a predictable river. And we knew, and our ancestors knew, how the river acted in different scenarios. And they knew where things were going to happen. So they knew where it was going to flood and where not to build and where to put things and where not to put things. And of late, particularly in the 20th century, we've sort of thrown the, that book rule book out, and we've decided to build in places where maybe we shouldn't have been building. And we've decided to do things like remove barriers from rivers, or, you know, we don't really like the fact that the river meanders through this area, and we've decided to straighten it and put nice concrete banks around it. And that's going to increase the flow of the river, and it's going to potentially increase the flood risk downstream.
Philip, you were visiting the Cascade project in Ballina, and I saw some reference to that. And that sounds like an interesting coalition of people and planning and
water.
And water, climate change, yeah. But just before we go, do you mind telling us a little bit about it?
Sure. So this is a Creative Ireland funded project in Ballina that we've
Ireland is an arts organisation.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's a climate change fund that they've run in the last number of years. And it's really about building social cohesion in communities through the arts and through creative processes. But this is in Ballina, County Mayo. We've been working on it for, I guess, maybe nearly 2 years now. And it was about two things. The fact that climate change in Ireland, as Susan says, is very watery in terms of impacts. And particularly in the west of Ireland, it's all to do with increased rainfall intensity. So, yes, we're going to get more rainfall, particularly during the winter, but it's the amount of rain that falls in a particular area and in a particular period of time that is quite challenging. And it then also, the project looks at the laneways in Ballina, which are a key part of the heritage of the town, but also how people use the town, constantly being used. But they are being damaged. They're in poor condition because we don't look after the rainwater goods on our buildings. So this project brings those two things together, works with the community through different stages, but through activities, critically, sort of co-creation activities. Initially, trying to understand the relationship of the town to water today, but also in the future. And if you know Ballina, it's all about a huge, powerful river going down it and a lot of rain.
So they're talking about flower beds, guttering, but also making the laneways easier to walk through.
We asked different sectors of the community, including school kids, well, what do you think the solutions are here? And so we've done a demonstration of some of those solutions, and that includes rain boxes, so new gutters and new downpipes. I mean, it sounds quite dull, but actually they're fabulous. We have a green wall, which is fed by water coming along the top from a gutter, effectively a long gutter that just allows the water to seep down through this planting. And suddenly this laneway, which is called O'Hora's Lane in the town, we think named after Ida O'Hora, is suddenly animated a bit, and it hopefully will connect people with water. But it was all about engaging with the community through activities, which is actually coming back to Patrick Geddes, exactly what he wanted to say.
And they have a great website. They have a really good website. And speaking of web, if you're interested in towns, the research from Philip Crowe from UCD and Susan Hegarty from DCU is definitely worth checking out. That's it. Thank you very much for the two of you. Brainstorm is produced by Ciarán O'Byrne. The sound engineer was Dave Gibson. It's edited by Jim Carroll and Aoife Ryan Christensen, with thanks to Taija Aaron, Research Ireland. And for more, go to rte.ie/brainstorm. Thanks.